Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
If you don't like who's in there, vote them out. That's what election day is all about. The biggest gun we've got is called the ballot box. So if you don't like who's in there, vote them out. Vote them out.
Vote them out.
Vote them out.
Vote them out.
And when they're gone, we'll sing and dance and shout. They bring some new ones in, and we'll start that show again. And if you don't like who's in there, vote them out.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, news, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm Patricia Colbert, and I'll be your host for the next hour. That song in the background is Vote 'Em Out by Willie Nelson. Today on The Mole, as your well-read read, I'll be reading you an excerpt from an article about political polling and the false promises of polling as a democratizing force. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, in their Left in the Law segment, deconstruct some other false promises that small modular nuclear reactors can safely and cheaply satisfy the growing power needs of the information economy. We'll close our show with a tribute to local labor and climate activist Loewen Berman, who died this past September. To start off, we take a look at the deeply entwined power structure of arms manufacturers with cultural and service institutions that undergird U.S. support for the unfolding horror show in the Middle East. Fran Michel speaks with Munira Lokandwala, Director of Technology and Training with Little Sis, about their project to expose this pernicious network of the U.S. executive class, otherwise known as the genocide gentry. Before we get rolling, I want to remind you that you are listening to Community Power Non-Commercial Radio, and if you like what you hear, please consider sending a donation to KBOO. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. And one quick announcement, a screening of the newly released second episode in the web series, How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse, written and performed by Mole Desiree Hellegers, will be held at Open Signal on Sunday, November 3rd at 6 p.m. Tickets are free on Eventbrite, but space is limited. For more information, contact Desiree.Hellegers, H-E-L-L-E-G-E-R-S, at wsu.edu. Now here's Fran with Munira Lokandwala.
Good morning. I'm Fran Michel, and I'm talking with Munira Lokandwala, Director of Technology and Training with the Public Accountability Initiative, also known as Little Sis, which is one of the creators of a project and website exposing the genocide gentry, the executives and board members of major weapons companies who also hold positions at academic and cultural institutions, making decisions about how to respond to the genocide in Gaza. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can you tell us, what is the Genocide Gentry Project and how did it come about?
Yeah, so the research was conducted jointly between ourselves, Little Sis, Adala Justice Project, and the Action Center on Race and the Economy. And it draws out the connections, as you said, between executives and board members at six major weapons companies. So Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, and Raytheon, as well as Elbit Systems of America. And we, you know, started simply by looking at the people who sit on the boards of these companies and starting to map out their connections to other institutions, right? So we looked at their business, we looked at other business positions that they had. But I think the thing that was most striking to us was how many connections we found just looking at these six companies to museums, cultural institutions, universities, and colleges. And, you know, we were interested in what felt like contradiction, right? To have people who are profiting from and benefiting from the sale of arms and weapons being hosted by these institutions of culture and humanities. And so we really wanted to kind of highlight this sort of contradiction and ask, why is it that these, you know, institutions of the humanities are giving prominent positions to people who profit from war and genocide? And so that was sort of how the research shaped the project. And I think in a broader way, we were seeing especially after the spring of 2024, the level of repression that was happening on college and university campuses, the silence from, you know, museums and art and culture institutions around the genocide, and, you know, wondering how it could be that as we're seeing Israel destroying every university in Gaza and nearly 200 cultural heritage sites since, you know, October 2023, how is it that these sister institutions in a way in the US are choosing to remain silent or even worse, repress any kind of protests around Palestine and ceasefire? And so that's a little bit of kind of what animated us deciding to kind of like look into these ties.
I know that here in Portland, organizers have targeted financial ties with some of these weapons corporations. For instance, Portland State University activists demanded the university cut ties with Boeing. Can you talk about how the sort of power mapping of people's relationships add to that work? If there isn't the explicit connection of Boeing is giving money to the university, what are we getting by seeing the individuals who are overlapping in these groups?
We're seeing in some ways, I think the research around the financial ties is very, very important. And it's been really powerful to see students, activists on college campuses sort of take that on and make demands around cutting these financial ties. And I think it's really important for us as organizers and as people kind of invested in this work to also understand the other ways that corrosive industries like defense and the fossil fuel industry are so deeply embedded within our institutions, right? That our colleges and universities are inviting people who are, you know, profiting from and enabling, you know, such destruction to happen, to then to invite them to come make decisions about how the university is run, is really problematic and something that we should really be asking why. What kind of expertise are these people bringing to our institutions?
One of the things that the genocide gentry research turns up is that there's a lot of overlap between weapons manufacturers, cultural organizations, and also fossil fuel organizations and corporations. Mm-hmm. What do we make of that, the fossil fuel military intersection there?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the industries are very much reliant on one another, right? They, pun intended, they fuel one another in various ways. And so, as you mentioned, many board members of weapons companies do have significant ties to not just fossil fuels, but also kind of neoliberal institutions and different kinds of extractive industries, think tanks and philanthropy. And this kind of network is really important because it is a network. It is, you know, a group of, and networks are groups of individuals, right, who are kind of building power through their shared connections. And so we do make particular note in this data set of individuals who hold ties to fossil fuel companies as a way to highlight that Palestinian liberation and climate justice are actually linked struggles, often having a shared kind of common corporation that is fueling the ongoing genocide in Gaza, you know, as well as kind of ecological destruction and climate crisis. And so that felt like an important thing to include because it's hard to ignore that connection is there, you know.
Case studies on the site Examples include not only universities, but also places like the Kennedy Center and groups like the Human Rights Campaign, which has some major corporate donors, including Northrop Grumman. Are there overlapping board members as well for something like the Human Rights Campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the list of corporate sponsors for the HRC, you see companies, corporations who are responsible for all kinds of, whether it be anti-worker or companies that are providing surveillance equipment or, you know, militarizing our police. And then, you know, the most egregious example are these defense companies that get to have their names and brands celebrated by an institution like the HRC simply by cutting a check, right? And again, that check, that money that they donate to the HRC is made off of the killing of people around the world, right? Including Palestinians in this moment. And so we really need to hold these institutions accountable for what it is they uplift, what it is they're sort of whitewashing by inviting, allowing these corporations to sort of make these kinds of donations, taking their money and then, you know, allowing them to sort of be celebrated at their galas and at their events. So, you know, while, you know, there aren't maybe multiple board members from these industries, we do see like many, again, really kind of corrosive industries, destructive industries that are welcome by these institutions.
So we're looking then at both the financial ties that often go along with these relationships, but also the more indirect kinds of policy pressures that individuals involved in these cultural institutions or academic institutions can be bringing to bear,
absolutely,
even without those explicit financial ties.
Right. I mean, we see that, you know, our higher ed institutions, our cultural institutions feel really vulnerable to the pressures of the sort of political landscape, right? And so one strategy, you know, for them has been to fundraise through bringing people like CEOs of weapons companies onto their boards. It, you know, it ensures a certain kind of potentially having access to different kinds of resources, but it comes at a cost, right? When you make decisions kind of based on, you know, having access to people who can fundraise for you or bring in large donations, you're doing that often at the cost of your own mission and at the cost of the public that you're serving. And so we're really seeing a real disconnect between these cultural institutions, who their public is, what their mission is, and who they're allowing to guide the decision making around how that institution is going to publicly engage with the genocide.
The site genocidegentry.org offers information about the people, the institutions, case studies, an organizing guide with examples. There's a map. The map of examples and case studies doesn't have any entries for Oregon, but the site notes that it can provide examples of the kind of research that people can do. What sort of things might people be looking into locally to pursue the kinds of research that you've given examples of here with Genocide Gentry?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, as you said, you know, it's by no means a comprehensive look at the war industry or the culture industry, but it's a starting point for us to think about how to continue to put pressure on the institutions that we are engaged with locally. I think for the first many months of the genocide, there was a lot of emphasis on kind of trying to pressure weapons companies, trying to pressure policymakers, decision makers to, you know, call for a ceasefire. And now, you know, almost a year into this genocide, we're realizing that, you know, people, we need to continue to mobilize and put pressure. And actually, the best thing we can do is mobilize locally and put pressure on our institutions locally to make commitments not to take money from weapons companies, to create kind of standards for how they, and ideally, you know, make statements in solidarity with the people of Gaza. And so I think this research is meant to help open up the view into how the points of pressure don't just exist in DC or in the places, you know, where these weapons companies are headquartered, but that they have a much wider reach. And seeing where that reach lands in our kind of local context is a helpful kind of starting point for organizing and for finding ways to build pressure and organizing locally around things like divestment.
If activists are interested in finding out more, I know that Little Sis has a database of connections among people prominent in business and government and so on, and also offers trainings for people interested in learning about this kind of power mapping research or in contributing to the database. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah. So as an organization, we're, you know, consider ourselves a watchdog research group focused on money in politics and also the networks of wealthy individuals, powerful organizations that are shaping kind of policy in the US. So we have three main buckets of work that we do. We produce independent research that we publish in the form of reports and articles on our news site, Eyes on the Ties. Often we publish research in partnership with various movement organizations to support their campaigns. Then we also do, as you mentioned, a lot of behind the scenes work, building capacity in organizations through training. And then we have a public training series this year that we launched called Research Tools for Organizers, which happens the third Thursday of every month and is really a way for us to help boost research skills and analysis across different social movement ecosystems that we don't work directly with in partnership, but can just help to start nurture. And then finally, as you mentioned, also we develop technology for activists, organizers, researchers, campaigners to use to build out their power research, to give it a home and to, you know, help people sort of not have to start from scratch when they're doing kind of research on things like big financial institutions, right? So if you're interested in a transnational global bank like Citibank, you can come to the Little Sis database and learn a little bit through the research that other activists have done to get a little bit of a kind of bearing on what Citibank does and is. And so we have littlesis.org database. And then we also have a mapping tool called Olographer, which is a way to take the research that's in the Little Sis database and turn it into a visual kind of story that you can share. And, you know, we think that power research kind of helps us gain more of an accurate picture of who we're up against and what those people care about. And power research can kind of help us demystify the corporate playbook and understand a bit better how they think and the networks and connections that they rely on to maintain their power so that we can really wage a good fight, you know, a well-informed fight.
Is there anything else that you would like people to know about this project or about Little Sis and its work?
Again, to just kind of plug the Research Tools for Organizers training series, which has been really popular and successful. And we've been really excited to see how many people who are just kind of starting on the work of campaigning and organizing locally are finding it helpful to learn new research skills, but I think also in many ways, just like connect and see that there's others working on these similar issues kind of across the country. So I think it's been a way to actually, during this time, I think during this past year when things have been really bleak and hard, to see that there are so many people who are being mobilized and galvanized in this moment to learn new skills and to apply those to the work of, you know, collective liberation and holding corporations accountable. So yeah, just put another plug in for that research training series.
Well, thank you so much, Munira Lokhandwala, for talking with us today about the genocide gentry and Little Sis and the work you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Fran. It was great to chat with you.
These rich men, north of Richmond, Lord knows they all just want to have total control. Want to know what you think, want to know what you do, and they don't think you know, but I know that you do, because your dollar ain't and it's taxed to no end.
That was a clip from a song titled Rich Men North of Richmond by Oliver Anthony. Before that, Fran Michel was speaking with Munira Lokhandwala about the genocide gentry. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Political polling is a phenomenon that does more to undermine democracy than enhance it. So argues Samuel Earle in his review of a book by G. Eliot Morris called Strength in Numbers, How Polls Work and Why We Need Them. Morris is an unapologetic cheerleader for political polling. Samuel Earle has a lot of issues with that. His review of Morris's work appeared in the New York Review of Books on October 17th of this year, and a link to the full article is posted on kboo.fm. This morning, as the Mole's well-read read, I'm going to read excerpts from the first part of the review. Next week, I'll read his analysis of polling's mutually self-serving relationship to the press. Here's Samuel Earle. In 2008, Nate Silver, a 30-year-old sports journalist, became an overnight celebrity after predicting Barack Obama's election victory with uncanny accuracy, calling 49 of 50 states correctly. His method was to aggregate multiple polls, weight them based on various factors, and then subject them to the kind of statistical analysis used to evaluate the performance of baseball players. In the 2012 presidential election, Silver picked the winner in all 50 states. The New Republic declared that it was 1936 all over again, a reference to the year when pollsters like George Gallup and Elmo Roper predicted Franklin D. Roosevelt's victory, upstaging more old-fashioned election forecasts that he would lose. Their innovation was the sample survey, gathering responses from a group of people deemed representative of the entire population. Silver's innovation was to bring the sample survey into the age of big data. The excitement of 2012 proved short-lived. In the 2016 election, polls were ubiquitous, but Donald Trump defied almost all their predictions and won the presidency. Worse than that, the polls were accused of enabling his victory by creating a fog of complacency that inadvertently sank Hillary Clinton's candidacy. Then in 2020, after concerted efforts by polling to correct previous mistakes, the polls ended up being more inaccurate than at any time since 1980. In his book, the journalist and data scientist G. Eliot Morris sets out to defend the polling industry. He argues that the real problem is the public's and the press's misunderstandings of how they work. Morris's bullishness is typical of the polling industry, a reflex that shields it from facing knottier questions about polling's political and social usefulness. To many, the point of it seems self-evident. Political polls measure political opinion, and every democracy should want its leaders to know what the public thinks. But that obscures their greatest achievement and larger influence, which lies in the industry's complete co-option of our understanding of public opinion. It has always been an elusive concept. In 1888, the British liberal politician James Bryce asked, "How does this vague, fluctuating, complex thing we call public opinion express itself in America?" A half century later, George Gallup announced that he had found the answer: polling with sample surveys. But polling's claims of accuracy veiled an intrinsic deception. It was all too easy to forget how reality is framed and flattened by the medium's design. Following their success in 1936, Gallup and his fellow pollsters promised that polling would revolutionize not only our understanding of public opinion, but democracy itself. Thanks to their new instrument, Gallup wrote, the will of the majority of citizens can be ascertained at all times, ensuring that dictatorships will become mere boogie stories to frighten our great-grandchildren. Gallup and Roper did not invent the sample survey. They imported it from the increasingly professionalized field of market research. It is hard to determine whether advancing democracy was an honest goal or simply part of their marketing spiel, but it's clear they thought that political polling would make them rich, said Roper. I saw it as a veritable gold mine if we could learn fast enough how to use it in all of its ramifications. But these early pollsters preferred to ground the industry's origin story in the scientific method rather than the profit motive. Some of polling's problems are indeed typical of the natural sciences. supposedly objective methods were and still are suffused with the prejudices of their day, creating blind spots and distortions that only become clear in hindsight. Such problems persist. One explanation for polling's failure to predict Trump's win in 2016 is that college graduates who were more likely to favor Clinton were overrepresented among respondents. In addition, the results of any poll on a particular issue or candidate are liable to change how people think about that issue or candidate. The effects are unpredictable. Add to this respondents' hypersensitivity toward the wording of questions. Roper once quipped that you can ask a question in such a way as to get any answer you want. But the most fundamental problem with polling is that the phenomenon it claims to record, public opinion, has no coherent meaning or existence. The polling industry resolves this conundrum by simply making public opinion synonymous with its methods. Polls record public opinion. Public opinion is what polls record. Skeptics could see this sleight of hand from the start. Dr. Gallup does not make the public more articulate, Lindsay Rogers, a political scientist, wrote. He only estimates how in replying to certain questions it would say yes or no or don't know. Polling in this analysis was not so much an infant science as an infantilizing one. One of the oldest and most ambiguous concepts in the social sciences was reduced to a simple percentage. 60% think this, 40% think that. The conceits of such a percentage have been exposed by many researchers. In an experiment conducted in 1980, people were asked whether they thought the 1975 Public Affairs Act should be repealed. A third gave an opinion, even though the act does not exist. A follow-up study in 1995 found that when people were told that either President Clinton or the Republicans wanted to repeal the act, more than half of respondents had a view. Morris's book is filled with fighting talk. Whatever the doubters say, polls remain, he says, one of the most democratizing forces in American political history. Morris even suggests that critics of polling are enemies of democracy, arguing, in many cases, the denigration of polls is made by elites, elected officials, and the ideological activists who have a stake in the public's voice not being heard. That was part one of a reading of a book review by Samuel Earle titled The Problem with Polls, published October 17 in the New York Review of Books. Next week, I'll be back with Earle's conclusions about the self-serving relationship between polls and the press. I'm Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Vote Baby Vote by Dee Light. Next up is Left in the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker. Today, they talk about the current push by Amazon, Google, and Microsoft to unite big tech with small nuclear to satisfy their corporations' voracious appetites for electricity and the cynical play on voters' fears to promote a nuclear renaissance.
Well, Mike, next week is the election, and they're worries and anxieties abound over the outcome, particularly of the presidential election. Climate change has not been a central theme of the Harris campaign or many of the other campaigns that have been covered nationally, other than the contrast between it recognizing it as a serious problem versus the Republicans who mock it or dismiss it. Drill, baby, drill is their tagline. So let's start with what's coming up here in the Pacific Northwest. There are four ballot measures in the state of Washington to cut back or scale back Climate Commitment Act in Washington. So there's always, it's always kind of this feeling of you gain something and then it's immediately attacked. Let's talk about those and then turn to how big tech is entering into the climate crisis with its own false claims of a pathway out of the problems we're facing.
Yeah, and the climate problem or the global problem of global heating has just been completely absent from the presidential campaign because Trump is against it, and that has made the opposition to the whole notion of global heating a basic part of the Republican position. And since the Democrats, they don't want to annoy anybody who's dependent on fossil fuels, like particularly in the state of Pennsylvania. So they don't say anything. They already know they're going to get the votes of people who are concerned about the issue. So nobody talks about it, even though we've had colossal instances of how global heating is killing people. Hurricane Helene is killing people in Asheville, North Carolina, hundreds of miles from the Atlantic Ocean. And I think lots of people are, even as things get measurably worse, are getting weary and tired and afraid of the whole issue.
The conspiracy thinking of Trump and his gang kind of takes center stage in the news. These claims that the federal government is only providing aid, is not providing aid to Republicans and can control the weather and has created the crisis to benefit Democrats. So there's so much noise of this sort that it's hard to focus, I think, for many people on the broader known dynamics. And even here in the Pacific Northwest, the blue Pacific Northwest, it's difficult to hold on to any kind of even partially progressive legislation. Can you say a bit about these four initiatives on the ballot in the state of Washington that aim to cut back in various ways the Climate Commitment Act, which has been seen as progressive and important in coordinating with other states, some of the requirements on companies that make it much more difficult to pollute? And it's not just a cap and trade scheme, which initially it appeared to be, apparently has more teeth to it.
Well, it has drawn the ire of big tech billionaires, as we've seen play out in San Francisco and in California, where the initiative process is alive and well. So we've had a man named Brian Haywood has financed these initiatives, which would take back laws that are not perfect, but they were passed with the dangers of global heating in mind, and they do make some measurably good steps toward combating, doing what people can do. We'll see what happens. I have not kept up with polling, but there is a very powerful fight back program by a group called Defend Washington against all four of these initiatives.
And
So
they have a
we
website that's it's quite informative in laying out the problems with each of these initiatives. They all seem to play on fears around inflation and fears of technologies that can make a difference, like claiming that people will be forced to have heat water pumps in their houses or forced to do this or that. And the sense that we won't have our bacon.
We won't have our gasoline, this nation of gearheads. That's really a fundamental threat. Increased prices at the pump. That's always an argument. Another thing happening with the climate crisis is an exploitation of that crisis by big tech companies who are trying to revivify nuclear power. They're saying that AI and data centers are going to be monstrous gobblers up of energy, and that the only possible way we can float this wonderful thing of AI is to reactivate nuclear power.
And just putting that in some context, the Climate Commitment Act does have within it $26 million for a proposal that would support implementing small modular reactors in the state of Washington and moving along the proposal process. And so that is a problem with how many of these, including the Inflation Reduction Act at the federal level, many of these clean power initiatives involve an obscene smuggling of nuclear power proposals into the warm and cozy folds of clean, safe, and cheap, none of which apply to nuclear power, including these designs for small modular reactors. But you're responding to a lot of the recent news that the big data centers and AI are going to require massive amounts of electricity. And the only way they can meet the moment, claim their supporters in the media, is to invest heavily in these small modular nuclear reactors.
Yeah, they're acting like AI is not at all new. It's, think of Alexa and Siri. These are simply forms of AI are being used to justify the whole nuclear power thing, even though data centers will indeed require lots of power, but only a tiny fraction of all the power needs of the world are going to go to data centers. Most recently projected global growth in electricity from 2023 to 2030, terawatt hours of data centers are 223, but space cooling is going to be 697. New buildings will be 1,219, electric vehicles 854, space heating 486. So data centers are a tiny fraction of all the uses to which electricity will be put.
They do have a public relations problem as they've landed with a very heavy footprint in around towns and communities. It's kind of like Walmart, exponentially bigger. And the local utility companies say, we cannot provide your voracious needs for electricity, which are still substantial. So the big data argument is that we can have big data with small nuclear. It's the marriage of big and small, and have claimed that they'll be able to fire these data centers with their own power using small modular reactors, which is an absurd claim, a false claim, because these reactors don't exist. They're in a proposal form. It takes 10 to 20 years for these models to go from the development to operation phase or longer, and they are very expensive, and the problems are extremely consequential. So it seems to me like a bad faith public relations campaign, whatever electricity they need, which is substantial, to say it's going to come from nuclear.
What's new about small modular reactors? Anything at all?
It's the modular concept, and some people describe them in the marketing materials. They look like Legos, and you can get like a little starter kit. A community can get a few of them, and then you can build up with more unit. No community can build a light water reactor, those big towers that are way too expensive. I mean, Georgia customers will be paying for the reactor that finally started there after decades for a very long time. But the small ones seem to be cheap. But if you scale up to meet the demands that are and projected numbers that are required to make any difference in the climate crisis, the costs are phenomenal and are even higher, and the waste more problematic than the large light water reactors. Most of what's new is in the packaging and the branding. They really domesticated the imagery of reactors. That's always been haunted by its association with death from its very birth from the atomic weapons industry during World War II and Eisenhower's announcement of Atoms for Peace. Death has always been its shadow. So it's perpetually resurrecting itself as clean and modern, futuristic, These smart people will figure out all these problems down the road, even though people have been working on them since the Second World War on what to do with waste and have not figured out the problem.
So they don't know anything about anything more about how to handle this toxic waste, and they remain vulnerable to big events like tsunamis or earthquakes.
If you want a very tragic cautionary tale on that industry and the attempt to revive it, look at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, where this proposal is now afloat to launch a site in the Hanford area. It's such a project of deception and bad faith.
Jen, let me ask you a basic question. Are there any of these SMRs or small modular reactors alive today? I mean, has one actually been built anywhere?
Well, there are a few in the world. Apparently, China has a few and Russia has a few that have been hobbled with various problems. In the US, none have been approved. None of these proposals have been approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Here in Oregon, NuScale is a company that was very proud of being the leader of the pack, mainly because they had used a scaled down version of the old light water reactor technology. And they had gotten some initial approval of a design, but they were not able to get customers. And that company has really been close to going under because they have not been able to get contracts. These are so far in the future from being realized. It's a hustle that distracts us from the real problems we face.
The cost estimates I've seen have been grossly larger than solar energy, which has now become extremely cheap because it's hit economies of scale. They've got factories now that can churn out continually advancing solar panels at ever cheaper and cheaper and cheaper prices.
And these
So
are known technologies, not perfect. There's a whole question of how much we should depend on generating more and more power for an ever increasing a world increasing in its demands for electricity, and how much we should look at where a lot of the energy consumption is going, conservation, and what kind of growth is really sustaining human well-being.
that's a whole other question. I mean, there are issues precisely of lifestyle, but then there are also issues of equity. Like there are huge chunks of the world that have nothing like the amount of cheap and available power that we have. And are we going to limit or restrict them in any way in their power development?
Yes, but the answer to that should not be exporting the worst of American technologies to those vulnerable communities around the world who have other models of innovation, of community-centered practices for generating electricity. There's a lot of innovative practices that have been marginalized by the glitter and glow of American technologies that have a long history of being foisted on other parts of the world to save them, to kind of technological saviorism.
Well, that's what we do. We create markets and then export to them whatever you're making. And I gather from your talk about atomic power and death and the relationship to weaponry that there must be a relationship between the increase, the modernization, quote unquote, in nuclear weaponry and this whole new urge to develop flawed systems of civilian electrical power.
The nuclear industry always claims that no, commercial reactors have nothing to do with nuclear weapons and the defense side until they're trying to get funds and are desperate for money. And then they say the defense industry needs us. It's the same engineers, the same scientists who know how to run these reactors who you will depend on the defense side. But they are bound together. So it's, I think, not an accident that there is this massive push to renew nuclear and to win the public support for this as a climate solution, as the US is taking on a commitment of $1.7 trillion to upgrade our nuclear arsenal during a time where we should be promoting nuclear disarmament here and abroad.
Well, they're hitchhiking on climate fears, which are very real. Beneath the level of politics and what's going to happen in November, I think young people in particular, but everyone, has a deep dis-ease, deep despair over the fact that they may be whacked by global heating. The unnerving general anxiety about it is what I think allows people to peddle something so shaky as new, quote unquote, nuclear power designs.
Okay, well, we'll talk with you on the other side. After the election, we'll be revisiting this. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Savior in the air. Will you shout or will you cry when the fire ain't from on high? Are you ready for the great atomic power? Do you fear this man's invention that they call atomic power? Are we all in great confusion? Do we know the time or hour when a terrible explosion may rain down upon our land, leaving horrible destruction, blotting out the works of man? Meet the Lord. Give your heart and soul to Jesus. He will be your shielding sword. He will surely stay beside you, and you'll never taste of death, for your soul will fly to safety and eternal peace and rest.
Are you ready for the great atomic power? Will you rise and meet your Savior in the air? Will you shout or will you cry when the fire ain't from on high?
That was the Leuven Brothers with their song Great Atomic Power from 1952. Before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talked about how AI companies have teamed up with the nuclear energy sector to raise nuclear energy from its grave. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Nothing stands between us and the life-killing projects of big money like a courageous social justice activist. Today, the Mole would like to honor the memory of one of our own, local labor and environmental activist, Loewen Berman, who died this last September at the age of 82. This segment was produced by Desiree Helligers, who conducted the interview with Loewen in 2017. It is Loewen's voice you hear along with Desiree.
To me, fossil fuel organizing is part of a continuous life of organizing and activism. During the megaloads is when I got involved, when we were trying to block the movement of heavy equipment up to the tar sands. That's when I became involved with Rising Tide, really embraced the Rising Tide activism and the horizontal organization. But really, I don't see that activism around fossil fuels as anything different from my activism around racial justice or anti-poverty or union or anti-war work. So in that sense, I've been active for about, 55 or 60 years. Why I became involved in climate work in particular is because it seemed to me it was the overwhelming issue facing the world right now, and one which, unlike some of the others, had a timeline to it, which meant that didn't have much time to act. Of course, the victory of Trump and Trumpism and the right wing in the U.S. has made that even more of a lost cause, if you will. But nowhere in the world is any government really taking action at a level that would be required. Again, you know, people have used the analogy of the mobilization around World War II, where in a matter of months, the U.S. completely changed its industrial focus and began producing for the war effort. What would be required to really meet the challenge of climate change would be a comparable tremendous change in the entire U.S. economy. And it's quite possible, as was shown during the World War II mobilization, but it's not going to happen unless people are forced to do it. And so far, our attempts to force the system, and when I say the system, I'm talking about global corporate capitalism. I mean, I think that's very clear, that there really is no solution to climate change within the context of global corporate capitalism, unless and until capitalists decide that it's in their monetary interest to do so. If there's any hope right now, this is not a happy thought and not something that folks would probably agree with, but I think if there's any hope of really meeting the climate challenge right at the moment, it's that some sectors of the ruling class begin to understand that it is both necessary and to their financial interest to do so. I wish I could say that it's going to be a mass movement that will force rapid mobilization to meet the challenge of climate change, but I haven't seen evidence to date of people's willingness to engage in that kind of a movement. Clearly, there are some people who understand and who are willing to pay a heavy price. I'm thinking about the valve turners who have shut off the flow of tar sands oil for a whole day entirely across the United States and who may be facing many years in prison. But that's not a mass movement, and it's only a mass movement that would make the change. And my experience is that it's only when people are personally affected in ways that become intolerable that they really become part of a mass movement. There is only one issue, and that issue is a vision of a world in which justice and compassion and equality are central to the human experience. And whether it's climate change or war or, you know, immigrant rights or women's rights or white supremacy, I mean, all of these things are part of one picture of a world which is not characterized by those values and those concerns. And at the moment, that is most reflected by a system of global corporate capitalism in which these issues become of very little importance and are always subsumed under the need for profit, a system based upon personal greed and short-term gain. And what's happened in my lifetime is that that system has become more and more powerful, more and more hegemonic, and there are fewer and fewer alternative forces at work. Global corporate capitalism is an enormously effective system at producing stuff at great cost to the world and its inhabitants.
Can you talk more about your background in organizing, you know, how you first got involved in activism as a whole, and some of the connections that you might make between this movement and others?
Well, I got involved just out of applying the values that my parents had taught me about equality and justice. They had taught it to me not by virtue of their political activism. They weren't at all politically active. They were working-class Jewish folks in Chicago. My father only went through the eighth grade. My mother graduated high school. When I was in high school, my first activity was to march against nuclear weapons with a Ban the Bomb march in Chicago. I don't know what brought me into that, except, you know, I was kind of going to school and I was part of an interracial relations club and started to get some interest in that. And then by the time I was in college, I became more of an activist around civil rights issues, and I became very involved, first at the University of Illinois and then at University of Chicago very heavily. I decided I was a socialist and a pacifist, having never met either one of those, but got involved in a socialist organization at University of Chicago, sat in at the administration building, occupied the president's office at University of Chicago, learned some important lessons about the way in which we were lied to and manipulated by the university administration. Went off to Indiana University, where I continued being part of this socialist group. At that point, SNCC was very active across the South, and I became a SNCC support person, organized a support of freedom fighter program where we had people donating money to SNCC, and in return they would adopt a specific SNCC field worker and would get monthly reports about what that field worker was doing. Then went on, I actually got a job working for the National Labor Relations Board for a while and did that as a field examiner, then became a union organizer briefly, and then in Chicago, which was where I was living, became involved in a community organization that was aligned with other community organizations. We were the only white group, the others were mostly Hispanic, and we did anti-war work, we did racial justice work, we did youth organizing, and we ran people for political office, people who were explicitly radicals, and not because we thought we'd win, but because we used these campaigns as ways of doing organizing and so forth. I don't know, I eventually went back to school and got a master's degree in labor studies with the intent of teaching at a labor extension program like LIRC here in Oregon. I graduated when Reagan got elected and cut the funding for all those programs around the country. I was working in factories during a lot of this period of time and became a journeyman machinist and model maker. Ended up moving to Oregon and getting a job at OHSU, where I had a machine shop in the hospital. I was very involved while I was at OHSU, both in labor work. I was vice president of the local, of the first AFSCME local up there, which I helped bring in. I keep doing what I'm doing because I don't know what else to do with my life. This has been my life. It's the only thing that is meaningful to me. And so I will, I assume, continue doing it. You know, I fear for the rest of the human and non-human races, what's going to take to make that mobilization happen.
You've been listening to a 2017 interview with Portland activist Loan Berman. This has been Desiree Helliger for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That does it for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Fran Michelle, Jen Hocken, Mike Snedeker, and Desiree Helligers for their contributions. And a special thanks to our guests, Munira Lokandwala. As always, a shout out to the dedicated staff of your community radio station, KBOO. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Join the Moles again next Monday morning for more on the fight to free Palestine, a review of the 1998 film Primary Colors about a presidential election, a preview of a documentary coming to Portland about alternative economic systems to mitigate climate disaster, and more on the false promises of political polling. I'm going to leave you this morning with this message one more time from D. Light.